Thank you so much. I want to thank the student lectureship for giving me the chance to visit Kenyon College. I've never been here before. I've written about this college and about the annex that happened on Election Day, ground zero in the theft of American democracy. But I want to talk about that. You know, I'm going to talk about the environment, but I want to talk about it in the context of democracy, because right now we're spending a trillion. Now the GAO says $1.5 trillion that it's going to cost us in Iraq to try to bring democracy to that country, and you know, we should spend at least some of our attention and resources and bring it to Ohio, and to the rest of our country as well. And our democracy is under assault, not just through the electoral system, but and this is what I want to talk about the corrosive impact of excessive corporate power on a democracy, and particularly on American democracy. And you know, the democracy and the environment are intertwined. You can't really separate one from the other. The best measure of how a government functions is how it distributes the goods of the land, the shared resources of our society, the air, the water, the wildlife, the public lands. Those assets that are not susceptible to private ownership, but by their nature are the shared resources of the entire community. The commons are the public trust assets or public trust resources. And you know, every child, whether they're black or white or rich or poor or humble or noble, has a right to clean air and has a right to clean water and recreational places that are going to enrich their lives. But oftentimes what you see and particularly in tyrannical governments is that those assets are consolidated in the hands of a few wealthy entities within the society, and particularly nowadays large corporate entities through a variety of mechanisms. And that's kind of what, and conversely, you can't have a clean environment under any system, sustainably under any system except for a democracy, and particularly a locally based democracy. If you look around the world, there's a direct correlation between the level of tyranny in various governments and the level of environmental destruction. Whether it's right-wing tyrannies like Brazil during the 70s and 80s, or Saddam Hussein's Iraq during the 80s and 90s, or left-wing tyrannies like Eastern Europe and China and the Soviet Union, where environmental injury has today matured into economic catastrophe. I want to start by saying a couple of things. One is that, you know, we're not protecting the environment so much for the sake of the fishes and the birds. We're protecting it because we recognize that nature is the infrastructure of our communities, and that if we want to meet our obligation as a generation, as a nation, as a civilization, which is to create communities for our children that provide them with the same opportunities for dignity and enrichment and prosperity and good health as the communities that our parents gave us, we've got to start by protecting our environmental infrastructure, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the wildlife, the fisheries, the public lands, the landscapes that enrich us, that connect us to our past, to our history, that provide context to our communities, and that are the source ultimately of our values and virtues and our character as a people. And I also want to say this, that I've been disciplined over 25 years as an environmental advocate about being nonpartisan and bipartisan in my approach to these issues. I don't think there's any such thing as Republican children or Democratic children. I think the worst thing that can happen to the environment is if it becomes the province of a single political party. And I support in every election cycle both Republican and Democratic candidates who have a strong track record on these issues. But you can't talk honestly about the environment in any context today without speaking critically of this administration. This is the worst environmental president that we've ever had in American history. And if you look at NRDC's website, the Natural Resource Defense Council, you know, I wrote a book about this administration. And, you know, people say, well, that's partisanship. It is. And no, it's not partisanship. Partisanship is when, you know, if I had written a book about President Bush criticizing him because I'm a Democrat and he's a Republican. But if he were a Democrat, I would have written the same book. I'm not criticizing him because of his party or making, you know, excuses for my own party. If he were a Democrat, I would have written the same book about him. And I described in the book just wicked things that were done by this administration. And that's not partisanship. But if you look at, NRDC's website, you'll see they're listed 400 major environmental rollbacks that have been promoted or implemented by this White House over the past 7 years as part of a deliberate, concerted effort to eviscerate 30 years of environmental law. It's a stealth attack. The White House has used all kinds of ingenious machinations to conceal this radical agenda from the American people, including Orwellian rhetoric. When they want to destroy the forest, they call it the Healthy Forest Act. When they want to destroy the air, they call it the Clear Skies Bill. But most insidiously, they have put polluters in charge of virtually all the agencies that are supposed to be protecting Americans from pollution. They appointed, as head of the Forest Service, President Bush's appointee is Mark Rae, a timber industry lobbyist, probably the most rapacious in American history. As head of public lands, a mining industry lobbyist, Stephen Griles, who believes that public lands are unconstitutional. And he just went to jail for 10 months for these sweetheart deals he was making with corporate polluters who wanted to steal America's landscapes. As head of the Air Division at EPA, a utility lobbyist, Jeffrey Homestead, who in his previous career represented nothing but the worst utility air polluters in our country. As head of Superfund, a woman whose last job was teaching corporate polluters how to evade Superfund. As second in command of EPA, a Monsanto lobbyist. I did an article for Vanity Fair a couple of months ago where I showed the top 100 enforcement environmental officials in this administration are virtually without exception lobbyists for the worst of the worst polluters within, not just the polluting industries, because within each of the industries there's good actors and bad actors. In the oil industry, you have Hess Oil and Conoco and BP and Shell, which are kind of decent, and then you have Exxon and Texaco and Chevron, which are diabolical. These lobbyists come from the worst of the worst, the bottom feeders in each of these industries. The New York Times just did it. In the Department of Commerce, which regulates fisheries, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, the EPA, the FDA, all of them, even the relevant divisions of the Justice Department. The New York Times recently did a series on this character, Philip Cooney, who's the president's number one environmental advisor. He's the head of Council on Environmental Quality. His office is in the White House next to the Oval Office, and his job, ostensibly, is to advise the president on the environmental impacts of every decision he makes. Philip Cooney's last job was as chief lobbyist for the American Petroleum Institute. And as it turns out, his principal preoccupation over the past 7 years has been combing through every federal scientific document issued by all the different agencies of government and removing or redacting or suppressing any inculpatory or damaging statements about the oil industry and the coal industry. He suppressed 12 major studies on global warming. Taxpayer-funded studies that you and I paid for. And the ones that he released, he altered and made hundreds and hundreds of alterations. This man is not a scientist. He's a lobbyist. And these were scientific documents. So his job is to lie to the American people to protect corporate profit-taking. And, there's nothing wrong with having business people in government. It's a good thing if your objective is to recruit competence and expertise. But in all of these situations, these particular individuals have entered government service, as I show in my book and this article, not to serve the public interest, but rather to subvert the very laws that they're charged with enforcing in order to enrich the president's corporate paymasters. And they have imposed tremendous diminution in quality of life on the people of this country. Most Americans don't know about it because we have a negligent and indolent press in this country that has simply let down American democracy. But in my book, I talk about all these industries that have a chokehold on this administration, corporate hog farms and industrial agriculture and the nuke industry and the chemical industry. But just talk about one industry tonight which has really the biggest impact on Ohio, which is coal-burning power plants. And I have three sons who have asthma. One out of every 8 American children now has asthma, and one out of every 4 black children. in America's cities has asthma. We have an epidemic of pediatric asthma. We know that the principal trigger for asthma attacks is bad air, ozone and particulates. And the primary source of those materials in our atmosphere are 400 coal-burning power plants that are burning coal illegally. It's been illegal for 18 years under the Clean Air Act. They were supposed to have removed those materials from their stacks. In many states, they did. For example, in Massachusetts, all of them did. They installed, you know, scrubbers and other mechanisms for strippers and scrubbers for removing that material from their stacks. And generally, what you find is in the blue states, they removed it. There's 1,100 of those plants in the country. The blue states were the plants were required to remove to comply with the law and to remove those materials. But in the red states, where corporations can easily dominate state political landscapes, they didn't have to do it. And, you know, the states simply refused to enforce the federal laws. And they're the frontline enforcers. So it didn't get done. Well, the Clinton administration was prosecuting the worst 52 of those plants criminally and civilly for violating the law. And they were investigating 200 more. But this is an industry that donated $156 million to the Republican Party and President Bush since 2002. And one of the first things that President Bush did when he achieved office was to order the Justice Department and EPA to drop all those lawsuits. The top three enforcers at EPA, actually four, Bruce Buckheit, Sylvia Lawrence, Eric Schaefer, and Rick Biondi, all resigned their jobs in protest. These were not Democrats. These were people who'd served through the Reagan administration and the Bush administration before. The top Justice Department attorney who was in charge of these cases said this has never happened before in American history, where a presidential candidate accepts money from criminals under indictment, then orders those cases dropped when he achieves office. Immediately after doing that, President Bush abolished the new source rule, which was the heart and soul of the Clean Air Act, the most important provision in that statute. That's the rule that required those companies to clean up. President Bush ordered the abolishment of the new source rule, which was the heart and soul of the Clean Air Act. It was the most important provision in that statute. That's the rule that required those companies to clean up 18 years ago. So now there's no requirement that they ever have to clean up the ozone and particulates. And all of those plants, like in Massachusetts and elsewhere, that invested in the new technologies are now at a huge competitive disadvantage in the marketplace. And I'm going to be able to watch my children gasping for air on bad air days because somebody gave money to a politician. And if you go to EPA's website tonight when you go home, not NRDC's website, but federal EPA, you'll see that that single decision alone by President Bush to abolish the new source rule kills 18,000 Americans every year, six times the number of people who were killed in the World Trade Center attacks. But not just once, year after year after year after year after year. This is EPA's website, President Bush's own website that says this. And, you know, this should be the front page headline of every newspaper in this country every day. But you won't read about it in the American press. About 20 months ago, the federal EPA announced that in 19 states, it's now unsafe to eat any freshwater fish caught in the state, including Ohio, because of mercury contamination. The mercury is coming from those same coal-burning power plants. In 49 states, at least some of the fish are now unsafe to eat from mercury. In fact, the only state where all the fish are still safe to eat is Wyoming, Dick Cheney's home state, where the Republican-controlled legislature has refused to appropriate the money to test the fish. But in all... In every other state, at least some, most, or all the fish are unsafe to eat. We know a lot about mercury we didn't know a few years ago. We didn't know at least a decade ago. We know, for example, according to CDC, one out of every six American women now has so much mercury in her womb that her children are at risk for a grim inventory of diseases, autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, and kidney disease. I have so much mercury in my body just from eating fish. I got my levels tested recently, and any woman of childbearing years should immediately get her levels tested, particularly if you eat sushi or if you eat tuna, but if you eat any fish. But mainly sushi and tuna, astronomical levels of mercury are produced from those fish. And you can get your levels tested by going to our website, Waterkeeper Alliance website, and send us a little lock of your hair, and we'll send you back your mercury levels. My levels, as I said, and everybody should get their levels tested because it's, it causes, mercury is the most potent neurotoxin, brain poison. It's associated with Alzheimer's disease, memory loss, a lot of other bad stuff, even among adults. But my levels of mercury, as I said, just from eating fish, are 2.5 times what EPA considers safe. Well, I was told by Dr. David Carpenter, who's the national authority on mercury contamination, that a woman with my levels of mercury in her blood would have children with cognitive impairment. And I said, you mean she might have? And he said, no, the science is very certain. Her children would have some level of permanent brain damage. He estimated with my levels of mercury, a permanent IQ loss in those children on average of about 5 to 7 points. Well, today, according to CDC, there are 630,000 children born in this country every year who've been exposed to dangerous levels of mercury in their mother's wombs. The Clinton administration, recognizing the gravity of this national health epidemic, reclassified mercury as a hazardous pollutant under the Clean Air Act. That triggered a requirement that all of those plants remove 90% of the mercury within 3.5 years. It would have cost them less than 1% of plant revenue. And we know it works. When they remove the mercury within 5 years, the downwind of those plants, the mercury disappears from the fish and from the waterways, downwind of those plants. So it was a great deal for the American people, but still billions of dollars for that industry. And that's the industry that gave, $156 million to this president and his party. And about 8 months ago, the White House announced that it was abolishing the Clinton rules and substituting instead rules that were written by utility industry lobbyists that will require the industry to never have to clean up the mercury. The new rules, incidentally, were written not by government officials, as was the custom, previous to this administration, but they were written by a private law firm called Latham & Watkins, which is a great law firm in many ways, but it traditionally was the law firm, and no longer is, for the worst of the worst, utilities. Companies like the Southern Company, which is just a criminal enterprise. And the chief lobbyist for that law firm was a man named Jeffrey Homestead, who President Bush appointed as the head of the air division at EPA. So Homestead just took rules that he had written when he was a private attorney for his clients and made it American law. And saved billions of dollars for his cronies by imposing tens of billions of dollars of costs on the rest of us. And just to finish the story, Homestead's two top deputies at EPA were also former lobbyists for the Southern Company, which was the primary beneficiary of this new rule. And both of them, within 2 days of them promulgating the rule, 2 days after they finished promulgating, they left EPA to go back to work for Southern Company, their public service having been done. And Jeffrey Homestead, in October, finally left EPA to go to work for Bracewell Giuliani, which is Rudy Giuliani's new Texas-based lobbying firm, which is now the primary lobbying firm for the Southern Company and for also the worst of the worst polluters in our country. And so this is this revolving door of plunder that you get when you put corporations in charge of our country. I don't think I mentioned that Philip Cooney, after the disclosures came out about all the meddling that he had done, he's the president's number one environmental advisor, and he formerly worked for the American Petroleum Institute, which is primarily funded by Exxon Corporation. 2 days, he was forced out after the New York Times series came out on him. And 2 days later, he was hired by Exxon. And, he never stopped working for Exxon. He was working for Exxon, the whole time. It's just that you and I were paying him for the past 8 years. And that's the truth with all these guys. They're continuing to work for the companies that they came in to work, that they came in, and when they leave, they go back to work for those same corporations. I'll tell you another, we're living today in a science fiction nightmare where my children and the children of most Americans, including all the children in this state, can no longer engage in the seminal primal activity of American youth, which is to go fishing with their father and mother in the local fishing hole and then come home and safely eat the fish because somebody gave money to a politician. And I live 2 hours south of the Adirondack Mountains. I take my kids fishing and hiking and camping and swimming and hunting, and I was camping there 3 weeks ago, and doing whitewater kayaking up there. And this is the oldest protected wilderness on the face of the earth. It's been protected as forever wild since 1885. We had a right, the American people, to believe that generations of our citizens would be able to enjoy those pristine landscapes and lakes and forests unspoiled. But today, one-fifth of the lakes in the Adirondacks is sterilized from acid rain, which is coming from those same coal-burning power plants, and which has also destroyed the forest cover on the high peaks of the Appalachians from Georgia all the way up into northern Quebec. And this president, having accepted $156 million from that industry, has put the brakes on the statutory requirements that they clean up the acid rain. And EPA recently announced that this year, for the first time in the 30-year history of the Clean Air Act, the levels of sulfur dioxide as a direct result of those rollbacks have increased in America's air, an astronomical 4% in a single year. About 6 weeks ago, I flew over the coal fields of the Appalachian Mountains. I spent 6 weeks in West Virginia recently trying a case there and ended up getting the largest judgment in the history of the state against the corporate polluters in the state. But I took a lot of time out to fly over the coal fields of West Virginia and Kentucky, which I've done many times over the past 5 years, in our battle to try to stop mountaintop mining. But I saw something that if the American people could see it, there would be a revolution in this country. We are cutting down the Appalachian Mountains, literally, with these giant machines called drag lines, which are 22 stories high. I flew under one of them in a Piper Cub. They cost $500 million, and they practically dispense with the need for human labor, which indeed is the point. When my father was fighting strip mining in Appalachia back in the 60s, I remember a conversation I had with him when I was 14 years old, where he said to me, they're not just destroying the environment, they are permanently impoverishing these communities, because there's no way that you can regenerate an economy from these barren moonscapes that are left behind. And he said, they're doing it so they can break the unions. And that's exactly what they did. When he told me that, there were 140,000 unionized mine workers in West Virginia digging coal out of tunnels in the ground. Today, there are fewer than 11,000 miners left in the state, and almost none of them are unionized because the strip industry isn't. They're taking more coal, those 11,000 miners are taking more coal out of West Virginia today than the 140,000 were taking in 1968. The only difference is back then, at least some of that money was being left in the state for salaries and pensions and benefits and reinvestment in those communities. Today, virtually all of it leaves the state immediately to the right up to Wall Street, to the corporate headquarters of Massey Coal and Peabody Coal and Arch Coal and the big banking houses like Morgan Stanley, which own these operations. 95% of the coal in West Virginia is owned by out-of-state operations, and the state is being liquidated for cash using these huge machines and 2,500 tons of dynamite that they explode every day in West Virginia, a Hiroshima bomb every week. They're blowing the tops off the mountains to get at the coal seams beneath. Then they use these giant machines called drag lines to push the rock and debris and rubble into the adjacent river valley. If you go to Google Earth on the homepage, you can see, you can take a tour today of these mountaintops that have been blown up, the 460 of the biggest mountains in West Virginia. I flew over some of them. Some of the mines are, one of the mines I flew over is 450 square miles. It used to be a mountain. It's just now a hole in the earth. And they take the rock and debris, and they push it into the hollows, and they bury the valleys, and they flatten the landscapes. They've already buried, according to EPA, 2,200 miles of America's rivers and streams. Okay? Never be seen again. They, by the time this president leaves office, they'll have flattened an area of the Appalachians the size of Delaware. It's all illegal. You can, in the United States, take rock and debris and rubble and dump it into a waterway without a Clean Water Act permit, and you can never get a permit to do such a thing. So we sued them in front of a conservative Republican federal judge, Judge Charles Hayden in West Virginia. And Judge Hayden said the same thing I said. He said it's all illegal. It's been illegal since day one, and he enjoined all mountaintop mining. 2 days from when we got that decision, lobbyists for Peabody Coal and Massey Coal met in the back door of the Interior Department with Gail Norton's first deputy, Stephen J. Griles, who was a former lobbyist for Peabody Coal and Massey Coal. And together they rewrote the interpretation of one word of the Clean Water Act, the definition of the word fill, to change 30 years of statutory interpretation and make it legal as it is today, not just in West Virginia, but in every state, including Ohio, for anybody to dump rock, debris, rubble, garbage, construction waste, any solid material now into any waterway of the United States without a Clean Water Act permit. All you need today is a rubber stamp permit from the Corps of Engineers, which in some districts you can get over the telephone or through the mail. And this is what we're dealing with today. It's not, as I said before, it's not just the destruction of our environment. It is the subversion of American democracy. And, you know, you've heard these, you know, the big polluters and their indentured servants in the political process and their slick PR firms and their, you know, these phony think tanks that they have in Washington, D.C., like, you know, a Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, which are all polluter-funded, Cato Institute, all these phony think tanks, and they're phony tobacco scientists, you know, we call them bioinstitutes. And you hear them, like Fred Singer and, you know, these other, like, you know, scoundrels. You see them, they've been very effective over the past decades at marginalizing environmentalists as tree huggers or radicals or militants or, as I heard the other day, pagans who worship trees and sacrifice people. But there's nothing radical about the idea of clean air and clean water for our children. And we're not protecting the environment for the sake of the fishes and the birds. As I said before, we're protecting it because we recognize that it is the infrastructure of our communities. And, you know, if you talk to these people on Capitol Hill, who are promoting these kind of rollbacks, and ask them, and I've spent a lot of time doing this, why are you doing this? You have children too. What they invariably say is, well, the time has come in our nation's history where we have to choose now between economic prosperity on the one hand and environmental protection on the other. And that is a false choice. In 100% of the situations, good environmental policy is identical to good economic policy. If we want to measure the economy, and this is how we ought to be measuring it, based upon how it produces jobs and the dignity of jobs over the generations, over the long term, and how it preserves the value of the assets of our community. If, on the other hand, we want to do what they've been urging us to do on Capitol Hill, which is to treat the planet as if it were a business in liquidation, convert our natural resources to cash as quickly as possible, have a few years of pollution-based prosperity, we can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy. But our children are going to pay for our joyride, and they're going to pay for it with denuded landscapes and poor health and huge cleanup costs that are going to amplify over time and that they will never be able to pay. Environmental injury is deficit spending. It's a way of loading the costs of our generation's prosperity onto the backs of our children. And, you know, one of the things that I've done over the past couple of decades is to constantly go around and confront this argument that an investment in our environment is a diminishment of our nation's wealth. It doesn't diminish our wealth. It's an investment in infrastructure, the same as investing in telecommunications and road construction. It's an investment we have to make if we're going to ensure the economic vitality of our generation and the next generation. And I want to say this. There's no stronger advocate for free market capitalism than myself. I believe that the free market is the most efficient and democratic way to distribute the goods of the land, and that the best thing that could happen to the environment is if we had true free market capitalism in this country, because the free market encourages efficiency, and efficiency means the elimination of waste, and pollution is waste. And the free market would encourage us to properly value our natural resources, and it is the undervaluation of those resources that caused us to use them wastefully. I did an article for Rolling Stone about a month and a half ago where I showed that, you know, we could get off of oil within 20 years, simply by rejigging the free market so that it does what true free market capitalism is supposed to do, which is to reward good behavior, efficiency, and to punish bad behavior. But we don't have a free market in this country. I said to Jim Hightower the other day, you know, I was talking about how great the free market would be if we really had it. And he said, yeah, the free market's the best thing in the world. We should try it sometime. We don't have it. You know, what we have is a twisted system that is based completely on subsidies and monopoly, and that has distorted the marketplace in every sector of our economy, and given, you know, the worst corporations power over our lives. And it's not the efficiency that the free market promises us. But in a true free market, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. But what polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves by lowering quality of life for everybody else. And they do that by escaping the discipline of the free market. You show me a polluter, I'll show you a subsidy. I'll show you a fat cat using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay his production costs. That's what all pollution is. Corporations are externalizing machines. They're constantly devising ways to get somebody else to pay their costs of production. And if you're in a polluting industry, the most obvious way to do that is to shift your cleanup costs to the public. And, you know, make yourself rich, make yourself a billionaire by poisoning the rest of us with your pollution that you're supposed to have been cleaning up, which is, you know, we're all supposed to clean up after ourselves. That's a lesson that we learned in kindergarten. But, you know, what they, and I know that it's wrong what they're doing, but that's what they do because it makes them rich. And, you know, if you look at, if you know, what the Southern Company, when they put mercury up from their stacks in Mississippi or wherever, and it falls on Ohio or New York State, it makes it so I can't eat the fish anymore, and it poisons our children's brains. I pay, as I said, $30 for a fishing license every year, but I can't eat the fish anymore. The Constitution of my state, as the Constitution of Ohio, says the people of the state own the fish, and they own the waterways of the state, and they own the air. Okay? It's not the governor doesn't own them, and the legislature doesn't own them, and the fisheries department doesn't own them. The people own them. Everybody has a right to use the public trust resources. Nobody has a right to use them in a way that will diminish or injure their use and enjoyment by others. This is ancient law. It goes back to Roman times. It's in the Code of Justinian. I'll give you a little history lesson, and this is a bit of a digression, but this whole talk has turned into a digression. During the Roman times, the law was that they enumerated in the Code of Justinian the public trust resource, the shared resources of the society, which was air, water, wildlife, wandering animals, fisheries, aquifers, wetlands, dune lands, and they even had public forests back then, much like we do today, a little different. But the rule was, whether you're rich or poor, humble or noble, African or European, if you're a citizen of Rome, you have an absolute right to use your share of those resources. Nobody can use more than their share. You had a right, if you were a kid, you had a right, whether you're the poorest person in Rome, if you're a citizen, you had an absolute right to cross a beach, throw in a net, and take out your share of the fish. The emperor himself couldn't stop you. When Roman law broke down in Europe during the Dark Ages, the same thing happened that happens in every tyranny. One of the first acts, emblems of every tyranny are efforts by powerful entities within that society to privatize the public trust resources, to steal them from the public and make themselves rich. And this happened in every jurisdiction in Europe during the Dark Ages. In England, for example, King John said the deer no longer belonged to the public. The deer were an important food source for the poor, wild deer. But he said, no, only the nobility can hunt them now. They belong to us. And that's what got him in trouble with Robin Hood. At the same time, he privatized, he began selling monopolies to the fisheries of the Thames and the other rivers of England so that wealthy people now controlled the fish, which used to be an important food source. Everybody used to be able to fish. And he began erecting navigational barriers on the rivers of England so that what was once free, now you had to pay for it. The public was so outraged that they rose up and they confronted him at the Battle of Runnymede. And they forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which was the beginning of constitutional democracy on this planet. And the Magna Carta is the Bethlehem for all of our civil rights, for the Bill of Rights in our country. They all come from the Magna Carta, you know, including ones we don't have anymore, like habeas corpus. But they had additional chapters in the Magna Carta, including all of our Bill of Rights, on free access to fisheries and navigable waters and clean air, etc. In fact, in the 12th century in England, the 13th century in England, there was a Clean Air Act that prohibited the burning of coal in London, and you know, in private stoves or industry or whatever, and it was a capital crime, and people were executed for it. So you know, when the polluters say, "Oh, you know, we didn't know this was wrong," you know. These environmentalists just made all these laws up in 1970 after Earth Day. That's not true. The laws always existed. The right to clean air and clean water always existed. And there was tyrants and corporations who were always trying to steal them from us. And they always knew it was wrong. It was always against the law. And, you know, Earth Day after Earth Day, we just forced them to restate those laws and codify them. But they always existed. And so when Southern Company, you know, puts the acid rain in the air, that privatizes the publicly owned waters and the forests of the Appalachians, and when they put the mercury in the air that steals the fish, And when they put the ozone on particulates that cause a million asthma attacks, 18,000 people dead, they're privatizing public trust resources. They've privatized all the fish in New York State. They've gotten away with something that King John couldn't get away with. It was a democratic revolution when he tried it. But they've been able to do it here in this country, you know, through the manipulation of the democratic process. And so, and you know, what all of the federal environmental laws were intended to do was to restore not only these ancient rights, but to restore free market capitalism in our country by forcing actors in the marketplace to pay the true costs of bringing their products to market. And what we do in the Riverkeeper, Waterkeeper movement is we don't even consider ourselves environmentalists anymore. We have, you know, 160 patrol boats around all the major rivers around our country. Each one has a full-time riverkeeper, and we sue polluters on those water bodies to return the water body to the public. And what we consider ourselves, we don't consider ourselves environmentalists, we consider ourselves free marketeers. We go out into the marketplace and we catch the cheaters, the polluters, and we say to them, we're going to force you to internalize your costs the same way that you internalize your profits. Because as long as somebody is cheating the free market, it distorts the entire marketplace. And none of us gets the advantages and the benefits of the democracy and the efficiency and the prosperity that the true free market promises our country. And what we have to understand in America is that there's a huge difference between free market capitalism, which makes a nation more efficient, more prosperous, and more democratic, and the kind of corporate crony capitalism, which has been embraced by this White House, which is as antithetical to efficiency, prosperity, and democracy in America as it is in Nigeria. And, you know, I want to say this. There's nothing wrong with corporations. Corporations are a good thing. I own a corporation. In fact, I own a bunch of corporations. And they do environmental cleanup, and I have a water company and a number of others. And corporations are a good thing. They drive our economy. They encourage people to assemble wealth and then to risk it. And they create jobs, and that's what we want to do. But they should not be running our government. And the reason they shouldn't be running our government is because corporations don't want the same thing for America as Americans want. Corporations don't want democracy. They don't want free markets. They don't want they want profits. And the best way for them to get profits too often is to use our campaign finance system, which is just a system of legalized bribery, to get their hooks into a public official, then use that public official to dismantle the marketplace, to give them a competitive edge or monopoly control, and then to privatize the commons and to steal from us our treasury, our air, our water, our public lands, whatever. And, you know, when you see, you know, corporations, you should all remember this, you know, which is that when these Democratic candidates, you know, talk about corporations, you make sure they make this distinction. Corporations legally cannot do good things for our country. They cannot turn themselves into philanthropies. When you see Walmart bringing, you know, bottled water down to the Katrina victims, they're not doing that to be nice guys. They're doing it because they believe that there's going to be a reputational asset that is going to ultimately raise shareholder values. If Ray Scott, or Lee Scott, who runs Walmart, if he has a different motive for sending the water down there, his shareholders, any one of his shareholders can sue him, and they will win that lawsuit. It's called wasting corporate assets. A corporation cannot give away any of its assets unless the objective is to increase shareholder value. That can be the only motivation. And so it's illegal for them to do something nice. They can't turn themselves into philanthropy. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the way we set them up. We don't want Walmart to suddenly say, Lee Scott to say, I'm going to give all the money away, you know, and save nothing for the shareholders. Because if he did that, if he legally could do that, nobody would invest in a corporation again, and our economy would collapse. So we want them narrowly focused on shareholder value, but we would be nuts to let them anywhere near our government, because we designed them to plunder, and that's what they're going to do to us. And, you know, I just wrote the afterwards to Barry Goldwater's book, his 1955 classic, The Conscience of the Conservative, which launched the conservative movement in this country. And Goldwater in that book says the same thing that I'm saying. He says corporations, don't let them anywhere near our government. They shouldn't be allowed to contribute. They shouldn't be allowed to have a voice. He said they're economic entities. Keep them away from our government because they are going to steal democracy from us. And he understood that. And, you know, and that's why every politician, every visionary leader, the most visionary leaders in our nation's history, have all been warning Americans persistently since the beginning of our history against the domination of corporate power. Teddy Roosevelt, who is a Republican, said that America would never be destroyed by a foreign enemy, by an Osama bin Laden. But he warned that our democratic institutions would be destroyed, subverted, stolen from us by malefactors of great wealth who would rob them from within. Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, in his most famous speech ever, warned Americans against the domination by the military-industrial complex. Abraham Lincoln, the greatest Republican in our history, said during, in 1863, during the height of the Civil War, he said, "I have the South in front of me, and I have the bankers behind me. And for my country, I fear the bankers more." And Franklin Roosevelt, during World War II, said that the domination of government by corporate power is, quote, the essence of fascism. And Benito Mussolini, who had an insider's view of that process, said essentially the same thing. He complained that fascism should not be called fascism. He said it should be called corporatism because it was the merger of state and corporate power. And what we have to understand in this country is that the domination of business by government is called communism, and the domination of government by business is called fascism. And what we need to do... what our job is to walk that narrow trail in between, which is free market capitalism and democracy, and hold big government at bay with our right hand. And, you know, these guys on Capitol Hill say they're against big government, but they made the biggest government that we've ever had, and the government that's, you know, looking into our private lives and locking us up without habeas corpus and putting people off the street and sending them to be tortured in Syria and all that, you know, stuff that we never imagined before, and torturing people. And we keep big government at bay with our right hand, and we keep big business at bay with our left, and in order keep open this trail. And in order to do that, we need an informed public that is able to recognize all of the milestones of tyranny, you know, many of which we passed way down the road, okay, already. And we need an independent and aggressive press that is willing to stand up and speak truth to power. And we no longer have that in the United States of America. And that is a real danger to all of the things that we value about our country. And I want to say one other, you know, thing, which is actually try to get back to what I intended to say when I stood up here and got distracted, which is that, you know, we're not protecting the environment for the sake of the fishes and the birds. We're protecting it for our own sake because we recognize that nature enriches us. It enriches us economically, yes. It's the base of our economy. And we ignore that at our peril. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. But it also enriches us aesthetically and recreationally and culturally and historically and spiritually. And human beings have other appetites besides money. And if we don't feed those appetites, we're not going to grow up. We're not going to become the kind of beings that our Creator intended us to become. When we destroy nature, we diminish ourselves. We impoverish our children. We're not fighting to preserve those ancient forests in the Pacific Northwest, as Rush Limbaugh loves to say, for the sake of a spotted owl. We're preserving those forests because we believe the trees have more value to humanity standing than they would have if we cut them down. And I'm not fighting for the Hudson River for the sake of the shad or the sturgeon or the striped bass, but because I believe my life will be richer, my children and my community will be richer if we live in a world where there are shad and sturgeon and stripers in the Hudson, and where my kids can stand on the banks of the river and look out and see the small commercial fishermen of the Hudson River that I've spent 25 years defending their livelihoods and their property rights and their capacity to earn a living. And we have on the Hudson the oldest commercial fishery in North America. It's 350 years old. Many of the people I represent come from families that have been fishing the river continuously since Dutch colonial times. They use the same fishing methods, sustainable fishing methods that were taught by the Algonquins to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. And I want my kids to be able to stand on the banks and watch these men and women in their tiny open boats with their ash poles and their gill nets and touch them when they come to shore to wait out the tides and to repair their nets. And in doing that, connect themselves to 350 years of New York State history and understand that they're part of something larger than themselves. They're part of a continuum. They're part of a community. I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where there are no commercial fishermen on the Hudson, where it's all, you know, Gorton Seafood and Unilever in 400-ton factory trawlers 100 miles offshore, strip mining the ocean with no interface with humanity. And I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where there are no family farmers left in the state of Ohio, where it's all Smithfield and Cargill and Premium Standard Farms. Raising animals in factories and warehouses and treating their stock and their workers and their neighbors with unspeakable cruelty and contaminating the landscapes and the waters all illegally. And, you know, and none of these guys can produce a pound of bacon or a pork chop cheaper or more efficiently than a traditional family farmer. The only way they can do this, you know, the way they dominate the market is through monopoly control, through closing the stockyards, owning, you know, the slaughterhouses and everything else, and they're driving the family farmer off the our lands and turning our lands over to corporations, not because they're more efficient, but because they're more ruthless and they have bigger subsidies that are not available to the little guy. And they're driving the final nail into the coffin of Thomas Jefferson's vision of an American landscape rooted, of American democracy rooted in tens of thousands of independent freeholds owned by family farmers, each with a stake in our system of government. And I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where we've paved the landscapes and lost touch with the seasons and the tides and the things that connect us to the 10,000 generations of human beings that were here before there were laptops and that connect us ultimately to God. And I don't believe that nature is God or that we ought to be worshiping it as God. But I do believe that it's the way that God communicates to us most forcefully. And God talks to human beings through many vectors, through each other, through organized religion, through the great books of those religions, through wise people, and through art and literature and music and poetry and dance, but nowhere with such force and clarity and detail and texture and grace and joy as through creation. We don't know Michelangelo by reading his biography. We know him by looking at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And we know our Creator best by immersing ourselves in creation, and particularly wilderness, which is the undiluted work of the Creator. And if you look at every religious tradition throughout the history of mankind, the central epiphany always occurs in the wilderness. Buddha had to go to the wilderness to experience nirvana and self-realization. Muhammad had to go to the wilderness of Mount Hira in 609 and climb to the summit in the middle of the night and wrestle an angel there to have the Quran squeezed from him. Moses had to go to the wilderness of Mount Sinai for 40 days alone to get the commandments. The Jews had to spend 40 years wandering the wilderness to purge themselves of the 400 years of slavery in Egypt. Christ had to go 40 days alone to the wilderness to discover his divinity for the first time. His mentor was John the Baptist, who lived in a cave in the Jordan Valley and dressed in the skins of wild beasts and ate locusts and honey. And all of Christ's parables were taken from nature. I am the vine, you are the branches, the mustard seed, the little swallows. The scattering the seeds on the fallow ground. He called himself a fisherman, a farmer, a vineyard keeper, a shepherd. The reason he did that was that's how he stayed in touch with the people. And it's the same reason that all the Old Testament prophets and the Quranic prophets, the Talmudic prophets, the Upanishad prophets, all the way back to the pagan prophets like Aesop, all of them used parables and allegories. All of them came out of the wilderness without exception, and all of them use parables and allegories and fables drawn from nature as morality plays to teach us the difference between right and wrong and what the face of God looks like. And, you know, Christ did this in the New Testament because that's how he stayed in touch with the people. He was a revolutionary like all the prophets were. He was challenging the religious fundamentalism of his own time. He was constantly rebuking the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes who were the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons of his day, for binding up heavy burdens for other men to carry. And for impoverishing widows and orphans in order to aggrandize themselves. And he was saying to them, you know, this is the whole point of religion, all these rules and regulations in these books. He said, the law was made for man. Man was not made for the law. And he said to his followers, you can ignore all of these rules and regulations. You don't have to pay attention to the rules about the Sabbath. You can eat what you want. Don't worry about whether it's clean or unclean. It's not what's clean. It's not what you put in your body that makes you unclean. It's the way you conduct your lives, whether you conduct them with love and generosity and tolerance for others and kindness, and whether you embrace the impoverished and the poor and poverty and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's the point of religion. And this other stuff is a tribalism. It's an atavistic, you know, it's the very thing that real religion is supposed to transcend. It's an in-group, out-group kind of tribalism that appeals to the worst instincts of humanity. And all of the prophets were saying the same thing, that this structure that's created, you know, that's known as orthodoxy or fundamentalism, it's not, it missed the point that real religion is a search for existential truths. And that is that kind of fundamentalism is the end to that search. It's somebody who says all the truth you need to know is in this little book, and I'm going to tell you what it means. You know, it's an exercise in power. And Christ was revolting against that, and ultimately it was the fundamentalists who murdered him. And we should remember that today. Since he was saying things that contradicted everything that the common people had heard from the literate, sophisticated people of their time, they would have dismissed him as a quack. But they were able to confirm the wisdom of his parables through their own observations of the fishes and the birds. And they were able to say, he's not telling us something new. He's simply illuminating something very, very old, messages that were written into creation by the Creator at the beginning of time. And we haven't been able to discern or decipher them until the prophets came along who had immersed themselves in wilderness and learned its language and come back to the cities to teach us the wisdom of God. This is where our values come from. This is where the essential values that unite all of humanity. This is where our American values come from, too. We're so rooted in wilderness in this country. You know, from the beginning of our national history, our greatest philosophers, political leaders, theologians, poets were saying to the Americans, you don't have to be ashamed because you don't have the 1,500 years of culture that they have in Europe, because you have this relationship to the land, and particularly wilderness, and that's going to be the source of your values and your character. Frederick Jackson Turner, who was our greatest American historian, said that America, democracy, came out of the forest. Without these vast tracts of wilderness and woodland, we wouldn't have evolved the political system that defines us culturally, politically, our character, everything else. And if you look at every valid piece of classic American literature and poetry and art, the unifying theme is that nature is the critical defining element of our culture and the way that we view the world and the world views us. And you know, this is where our values come from. We now have an administration that's been able to sell itself to a gullible press and to some of the American people as an administration of values. But all the values that they claim to represent, to me, seem to be these hollow Hollywood facades, you know, that mask the one value that they're really consider worth fighting for, which is corporate profit-taking. They say they're conservatives, but they've torn the conserve out of conservatism. They say they like free markets, but they despise free market capitalism. What they really are trying to sell is this corporate crony capitalism, this ruthless capitalism for the poor and socialism for the rich. And, you know, they say that they like local control, but they only like that when it means sweeping away the barriers to corporate profit-taking at the local level. They say they like law and order, but they're the first ones to let the corporate lawbreakers off the hook. They say they like small government, but they've made us the biggest government in history. Fiscal responsibility, all that stuff is just a pretense. You look at what they're really doing, it's corporate control of this country. And we've lost our real values, and they've completely lost track of our real values. And I'd say this, you know, because we're torturing people today, and that is so dismaying and so shocking to, you know, this is something that they say, we live in dangerous times. We lived in dangerous times when I was a kid, when we had 25,000 nuclear-tipped missiles pointing at our country, each one capable of obliterating an entire city. And we didn't torture people. And we didn't suspend habeas corpus. And we didn't, you know, lock people in jail or bug hundreds of thousands of Americans. I had John Dean on my radio show the other day, the counsel of the President Nixon, and who went to jail for 4 months after Watergate. And he said, you know, we put one bug in one office illegally. He said, these guys have bugged hundreds of thousands of people. You know, what's going on? You know, why aren't they in jail? Why haven't they been impeached? And, you know, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was asked about torturing Confederates to get vital military information. He said, absolutely not. This country is the first country in the world that was based on an ideal, and that's the ideal of justice and democracy, and we're not going to do that. And he appointed a commission to develop rules for the humane treatment of prisoners, and that report, 50 years later, became the Geneva Convention. During the Revolution, when the British were torturing our soldiers in New York Harbor and killing them by dozens in these coffin ships every day, Washington was asked by his generals to do the same thing, and he said, I'd rather lose the war than do it a single time to reduce ourselves to that level. This is a nation that's based upon this idea of humanity, and we're not going to do that. And the Hessians that he captured at Trenton, New Jersey, were so shocked by the good treatment that they had received at the hands of their American captors that after 2 weeks in captivity, they walked unguarded from New Jersey all the way to western Pennsylvania to POW camps, and not a single one of them made an attempt to escape. They were so grateful to us. And during World War II, Eisenhower said, no matter what the Nazis are doing to us, we're not going to do it to them. And Germans surrendered to the American people during World War II by the tens of thousands, because they had been told by their fathers who fought in World War I, always surrender to an American, because Americans don't torture people. And, you know, when I was a little boy, I went to Europe with my father, to Czechoslovakia and Poland and England and France and Germany and Greece. And everywhere we went, we were met by these vast crowds of people, hundreds of thousands of people, who came out because they wanted to be near an American politician, because they loved our country. They were starved for our leadership. They were hungry for our moral authority. And it wasn't just because my father's brother had been martyred 4 years before. They did the same thing to Eisenhower. When he went to Kabul and to Tehran, he was met by hundreds of thousands of Muslim people waving tiny little American flags. We were the hope for all of humanity. And they proudly named their streets after our presidents, Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt and Kennedy. And I remember the day after 9/11, when the headline on the biggest newspaper in France, Le Monde, was, "We're all Americans now." And for 3 weeks after 9/11, Muslim people in Tehran, by the tens of thousands, came out onto the streets and lit candles, candlelight vigils, spontaneously, to express their support, their sympathy, their love, their solidarity with the people of the United States. And, you know, we were the most beloved nation in the history of the planet. And it took 230 years of disciplined, restrained, and visionary leadership by Republican and Democratic presidents to build up these vast reservoirs of love and respect for our country. And in 7 short years, through monumental incompetence and arrogance, these people have drained those reservoirs dry and lost and forfeited the biggest asset that we have, economic asset. And anybody who tells you that we're safer today because every Muslim in the world hates us, there's a poll, you know, there was a poll recently in Europe that showed that our president is less popular than Osama bin Laden among European youth. If you think that that makes us safer, if you think it makes us safer that Hezbollah is now more popular in the Middle East than the United States of America, which was not true prior to this presidency, you have a twisted view of reality. You know, anybody who tells you we're safer, that this has made us safer, is a joke. And, you know, we've lost our values, we've lost the respect of the world, and it's time now for those of us who understand what it is. Abraham Lincoln said, America is a great nation because America is a good nation. And when we stop being a good nation, we'll lose our greatness as well. And, you know, these guys have done something to our country that I never believed I would see. And it's time for those of us who understand what it is that makes this country valuable to stand up and fight back and take it back from those who don't. Thank you all very much for having me here, and thank you for being such a good audience. Thank you.